My name is Bob Wessel, and I'm an alcoholic. You know, I usually don't get too nervous when I talk, but I'm kind of shaking tonight for some reason. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the memories of so many people that have passed on that I've been friends of mine since I've been coming to Montego. First thing I guess I better do is tell you my sobriety date. My sobriety date is the 9th of November, 1962, and that's about 55 years. I have a sponsor, and I sponsor people, and I go to a lot of meetings, and it's just been a great, great journey. I would like to thank Shirley and Bo for kicking this thing off, and they've done a tremendous job, and I'm looking forward to tomorrow morning to Rena. I had the opportunity last night to sit over in a snack room and talk for a few minutes with Rena, and we shared a lot together last night, so I'm looking forward to her tomorrow morning. But maybe I'll settle down here in a minute and get into what I need to be doing. I don't know when I become an alcoholic. One thing I like to start off with telling a little story. It really describes what happened to me when I started drinking and when I wound up. I was a whole lot like the guy that stumbled in the tavern one Monday morning, and he was hollering for the bartender, "My God, I'm about to die. Man, I had a terrible weekend, and God, I need a drink bad." Bartender sent me up three shots and three beers. The old drunk, he got to stumbling around and trying to get his billfold out of his pocket, and the bartender went on, he set him up, and man, he jumped him on that bar stool, and he grabbed that shot of whiskey and dumped it right down. He grabbed that bottle of beer, and he just sucked it out of the bottle. It wasn't 30 seconds gone by, and he drank all three of them. And the bartender looked down at him, and he said, "My God, man, you sure drink fast, don't you?" He said, "Yeah, you'd drink fast, too, if you had what I got." The bartender said, wondering, he said, "My God, man, what do you got?" He said, "About 75 cents. That's pretty much about what happened to me, and maybe it's a lot of you, I don't know, but that's what happened to me. But I don't know when I took my first drink of alcohol. I can't remember. To me, it's really not important, but I do remember my last one, my last drunk. I remember that very well. But sometime the time I was about 15 or 16 years old in high school, drinking a bottle of beer was very, very important to me. So important that we took beer to school. We drank down in the boiler room with the janitor down there. We hid our drinks down there. He drank with us. And one day the principal of the school walked in, called us boys down there drinking with the janitor. And we were taken up the office, reprimanded for this, got out of it very easily, us playing sports. But that janitor, he got fired that day. He lost his job. And man, I picked up on that right away. I knew why I was down there drinking. I knew whose fault it was. It was that janitor's fault. He's the one. And you know, I blamed him and people just like him for the next 15 years of my drinking. When I was in high school drinking, I don't remember it being important to me, but I know I drank every day that I could, and I can look back now and I realize how important it really was. Just shortly before I graduated from high school and was 17 years old, I wound up losing my first job. I was a pretty good baseball player. I had a chance to play professional baseball. Right before I graduated, in about the middle part of April, I left with the Cleveland organization, and in 6 weeks they got rid of me, or I got rid of them. I don't know what happened, but I made my decision that I didn't want to play baseball. And I realize today that's a big lie. I really wanted to play baseball, but I wanted to drink more than I wanted to play. And I quit, come back to Louisville, and I fooled myself trying to convince myself that I was going to get married. And hell, Wanda and I were not even dating steady at that time. But we, Wanda and I, we kept dating off and on. Wanda had a bad habit of not wanting to date me all the time, not on a steady basis. I think it was because a lot of times I had dates with her and I would get to drinking, and sometimes I would be maybe an hour or two late, and I didn't think that was too important. And sometimes I'd even forget it completely. So we kind of broke up off and on after high school. And when I left that baseball team, I immediately continued to play ball. I played a little semi-pro ball around and made a little money on the weekends playing semi-pro ball. And I got a job in a company called Bearings Incorporated. I was in sales, and I eventually talked Juanita into marrying me. I caught her out one night. I don't remember exactly where we were, but I caught her in a weak moment. I whipped that engagement ring out and asked her to marry me. And Juanita gave me that ring back. She said, "I'm not marrying you." I said, "Juanita, why won't you marry me?" And she said, "Bob, you drink too much." And I remember that night looking back at her and those big brown eyes of hers. And I said, "Juanita, do you think that after we're married and I have a responsibility that I'll drink like this?" And I guess Juanita believed me. And I really believed me too. I thought responsibility would keep me from drinking. But I will assure you tonight, responsibility will not keep this alcoholic from drinking. Juanita and I got married. We had 7 children, and she was pregnant with the 8th child, and I was still drinking. And to me, that's a little bit of responsibility, I'll tell you. The things that happened during these years, I never really thought I was drinking too much. Now, Juanita did, and especially her mother did. I had a little problem with a mother-in-law. I hear a lot of times around AA's guys say they have to go back home to mom. Well, eventually I went back home to mom-in-law, And that was terrible. But after one end I got married, I don't think for a short period of time drinking was really a problem. But somewhere along the line, one end began to talk to me about what the drinking was doing to these children. And I tried many, many times to see if my drinking affected my children in any way. And I'm sure that I took that inventory probably on a bad time after Monday, like on a Monday morning when I was all hungover. And I'd stare into that mirror and those bloodshot eyes, my face would all be red and swollen. And I'd get the dry heaves, and then I'd think about what one had been talking about my drinking affecting these kids. And I always come up with the same answer. I don't know what the hell she's complaining about. These kids got a roof over the head or shoes on the feet. I'm the guy that's hurting today. I'm the guy that has to pull myself together this morning and go out here and go to work and earn a few bucks so these kids have got these nice things. But I can look back tonight, and I can remember many, many times pulling into that driveway. Right, I can see those 2 oldest daughters of mine now coming down that sidewalk, skipping down the sidewalk to meet Dad when he got off from work. I'd open that car door, and I'd stumble up that driveway in a drunken stupor, and I'd see those 2 little kids now. That smile drop off their face. Their little heads would hang, and they'd turn around and walk back in the house, get away from their drunken father. That didn't happen to me in 55 years around this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have never done anything my children had to hang their heads and be ashamed of me. And if that's all I got out of the program, it would be worthwhile. But, after one end I got married, and I told you I couldn't get along with my mother-in-law, and she couldn't get along with me. And the main reason was she didn't want me to marry Juanita. My mother-in-law knew long before one end I got married what I was. She knew I was an alcoholic, and she knew I was going to be trouble, and we just didn't get along very well. But after, I think I was about 20 years old, 21 years old, about a year after one end I got married, my mother-in-law went into business together. Now, you know, you got to be nuts to go into business with somebody that you hate, somebody that you can't stay in the same room with. But one of you talked to me about this. She said, this cannot work. My mother-in-law was in the real estate business, and she was very successful in it and offered to take me as a partner. And one of you said, this will not work. Well, I was interested in one thing. I'd got almighty dollar. I knew with money in my pocket, I could buy happiness, peace of mind. I could get along with my mother-in-law. Hell, I could do anything, you know, for money. And it was a pretty successful business for a couple years, and my drinking was picking up, and a lot of things was beginning to happen. One of them was beginning to talk to me about divorce. Any of y'all ever talk about divorce around your house? Hell, we talked about divorce like everybody else talks about the weather. We discussed it every week or so, and one of them got real serious one time about this divorce thing, and I used to say all the time, she'd threaten me with that divorce, and I'd say, Wanda, what do you want from me? She'd say, Bob, I want you to quit drinking. And I would for a week or 10 days, and we kissed and made up, and we'd done a lot of making up. We got 9 children, you know. But one time she got real serious, and this was on down the line for a while, but that business my mother-in-law was in, we worked out of my mother-in-law's house. Had a big front porch across her house, and across the living room, went all the way across the front of the house, and this is where the office was. And my mother-in-law sat down one time. I'd been in the business probably about 3 years with her, and we talked about building a new office there. And that's really was all was really said about it. And I don't know, it was maybe a year or so later, my mother-in-law made a big mistake. She took a vacation, was going to be gone for several months, and she'd no more than pulled out the driveway, and I decided now's a good time to build that office. Hell, she's gone. And me and this drunken builder who worked in the company with us, we got out a bulldozer, pushed the front porch off my mother-in-law's house, and built an office while she was gone. And when she got back, man, she was a little bit upset about that, I tell you. It just about broke the company is what happened. And it was about 6 months later, I sold my half of that business to my mother-in-law. My mother-in-law bought me out because it just about broke the company is what happened. But I drank at a place called Wolford's Tavern about 2 blocks from my office. And one used to come down there all the time, see me, always wanting money, always wanting money. And I'd say, what do you want money for? I think that time we had 4 or 5 kids, you know. And she'd say she needed milk or bread or something. It didn't seem that important to me. But anyway, to get rid of her, I'd give her $10, send her on her way. It wouldn't be but a week later, hell, she'd be back again, you know. And I used to say to her all the time, Juanita, what'd you do with that 10 I gave you last week, you know. So time to come around for this business. I was 25 years old, and we went into my mother-in-law's attorney's office one day, and they had all them papers made out. I saw what it was, and I grabbed those papers up, and I read, glanced at them, and sold my half of it, but I signed that thing away. And then they got the checkbook out, and that got my attention. They paid off all the bills we owed, and then they wrote me out a check. What was left was $7.85, and that was, hell, 60 years ago. But even back then, you'd get too drunk on $7.85. But you know the baffling thing about this? I was 25 years old, and I thought I was a pretty sharp guy. But it never crossed my mind then why I lost that business. I never thought about my drinking. I knew why I lost that business. That mother-in-law stole that business from me. And I'd get even with her someday for that. And I lived with that for the next 5 or 6 years before I sobered up, trying to get even with my mother-in-law. I continued this drinking, and a lot of things began to happen. I went into a business for myself. I didn't ask my mother-in-law to come into that as a partner. She wasn't going to get that one. I went into the insurance business, and I kept this other job that I had, and a lot of things was beginning to happen. One of them, once again, threatening me with divorce. And she got real serious one time about that divorce thing. And she said she was going to see an attorney, and she went over. I lived in a little burg called Shavley, and hell, I knew the mayor, and I'd worked on election day and got them elected, and all the hell, and the police chief knew me, and you. I got by with just a lot of things I shouldn't have. And the deputy sheriff knocked on my door one Friday night, happened to catch me home. I don't know how he done that, and I happened to be sober. I don't know how that happened either, but he gave me those papers, and I was a smart aleck drunk. I grabbed those papers, and I glanced at them. I saw what they were, and I ripped them in half. I said, "Moon, you take these damn things back. I don't want them." He said, "Bob, you better read them tomorrow when you sober up." He said, "The judge has already signed those." And I read them the next morning, and to this day, I cannot remember how much alimony Juanita wanted. But I got down that paragraph, you know, it says child support. Man, I read that one. She wanted $40 a week for each child that we had. And I wasn't too drunk to multiply 6 times 40. I could do that. And then I got to figuring this thing out. How in the world am I going to pay alimony, $240 a week child support, and drink? That's impossible to do, you know. So I went down and talked to the priest what I should do about this nutty woman I'm living with. You know, I was telling Father my side of the story. I'm working 2 jobs and all these things, you know. And Father was on my side. But he and I were sitting down there having a highball together that morning. And he had the same problem I had. But anyway, he called Juanita that day and said, "Get down here. I want to talk with you." And I thought, man, it's going to work out good. You know, I've got Father on my side. But you know, Juanita got down there. She told Father a different story than what I'd been telling him. And this is one time in my life I really wanted to make a change. I knew I was doing things I shouldn't be doing. I knew I was going to places I shouldn't be going to. And I knew I was with some people I shouldn't be with. I wasn't stupid. I was just drunk. But and Juanita, or Father One, came up with a brilliant idea that ought to take a pledge. I don't know if there's anyone here in this room who's ever been drowned in a pledge or not. But if you haven't, you don't have to be. For God's sakes, please stay here in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and do it the easy and the comfortable way. I knew what it was to sign a pledge. I read it. I just promised God I wouldn't touch alcohol in any form for 1 year. You know what I thought? Nothing to it. You put the plug in the jug and you don't drink. It's that simple. Wasn't that simple for this alcoholic, I'll tell you. Because I wanted to drink every day. And I couldn't drink because I'd signed that pledge. And I lasted 6 months that way. And Juanita has said many, many times in the program of Al-Anon, thank God I broke that pledge and took that drink. Because for those 6 months, I made that family, those kids, and Juanita as miserable as I was. If I'm going to be miserable, and you're going to be around me, you're going to be miserable too. And man, I was mad at the world. So I took that drink, and it relieved all that pressure we'd been living in a house. That's all it was a house that Juanita and I and these 6 kids was existing in. It was shortly after this that I was introduced to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. my brother lived on Skid Row in Louisville for 3 or 4 years and walked in the central office there one day and found some help. It wasn't long and he was beginning to stop by and tell me about this program. I don't know why Norman wanted to tell me about AA. But Norman believed in attraction without promotion. He never once ever promoted AA to me. He never said, Bob, you're an alcoholic. Bob, won't you look at how much you're drinking? Bob, look what you're doing to these kids and your wife. He never talked like that. Every day when Norman would stop by and see me down at that tavern, he would tell me about you people. He told me about what was happening in his life. And I was really attracted to what was happening to him. I thought it was really good for him. Never once thought about me, about my drinking. That never crossed my mind. And after Norman was sober 8 months, he and I was going on a fishing trip. And this will prove to you how rum-dumb I was from alcohol. Juanita had been trying to get Norman to take me to AA. And he said it won't work that way. Bob will have to call me and ask to go. And she told Norman, hell, Bob will die before we ever ask for help. I've talked to him about doing something about his drinking. He refuses. So this was Juanita's chance to trick me into AA. And I don't think it makes any difference if you're in AA or you're in Al-Anon. I don't think there's why you're here. I don't think the important thing is that you are here. But Norman and I was going on this fishing trip, and Juanita said, you're going down there to Cumberland Lake with Norman, and you're going to cause him to start drinking. And I said, no. I said, I went out to see my brother, and I did. I went out and talked to Norman, and I told him I may drink a beer or two while we're down there. And he assured me it would not bother him as long as he didn't drink it. Then Juanita threw that kicker in. She said, well, you say you really love Norman. If you really love him, what you ought to do is go to one of those AA meetings with him, and you could probably help him stay sober. And I thought for a few minutes, well, hell, I wouldn't mind going if it's going to help him. So off to an AA meeting we went. I'll never forget this. It happened to be on a Tuesday night. I remember it very well. These three guys picked me up. Norman was one of them, and out to a meeting we went. We rode 25 miles to a damn AA meeting. And these guys was talking about something. I don't know what they were talking about and cared less. We got out that meeting that night. It was way out in Radcliffe, Kentucky, and they didn't have a speaker that night. They played a tape of some Southeastern speaker. And I'll guarantee you tonight, it would not have meant anything to me if Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob would have both been at that meeting that night. I was not impressed with AA. We got back from the meeting that night, and Juanita was waiting me at the kitchen door. She had the coffee pot on and had baked the cake. And she welcomed me in, and Norman, and I shook my finger in her face. I said, you'll never take another damn night out of my life. My brother's been sober 8 months, not a thing I can do to help him stay sober. And I went out and got drunk that night. Well, she called Norman the next day and said, Bob didn't get a whole lot out of that meeting last night, but he wants to go Friday night. I didn't know I wanted to go Friday night, but she reminded me about that divorce still in action, and I agreed to go Friday night. And off to the Pleasant Ridge group we went. I'll never forget that. It was February the 4th, 1960. I walked into that room, and Juanita was introduced to the program of Al-Anon that night. She stayed with me that night, but the next night she went to Al-Anon, and she'd been a part of Al-Anon, a good member of Al-Anon for, 57 years, I think, yeah. And I kept going back to AA. I didn't find any help there, but for one thing, I wasn't listening to what was going on. You know, you hear around the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard this, I think, many, many times when I would go to meetings about being in the middle of AA. What is the middle of AA? I think the middle of AA is running with the guys or the gals that are successful in staying sober in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Those people who continue to go to meetings and are having a good time staying sober. I think that's what the middle of AA is. I once heard a speaker describe it as he has never ever in his life ever heard of anyone falling off the middle of a flat roof. And I thought about that, you know, for a while. And I thought, man, that's really what the middle of AA is. You know, we get in with the people that are successful staying sober, and we become a part of that group. And before long, we're staying sober right with them. Now, I wasn't that way. For the next 2.5 years, the only thing I'd done was go to AA meetings. And I'm sure someone along the line somewhere in one of those meetings that I was at, and I was at that home group, well, it was a group, it wasn't my home group. I was just at this group most every Friday night. I figured I was a good regular member of AA, but I'd never stopped drinking. Someone along the line, surely that God must have said something to me about, you're not supposed to drink and go to AA. But if they did, I didn't hear them. And I will never forget a gal by the name of Lil Nyland was at that group. And every Friday night that I was there, after that meeting, that lady would get me off in the corner after the meeting and she'd talk to me. And she'd hold me and she'd hug me. And she'd say, Bob, you have faith. Please keep coming back here. Please keep coming back. We need you. We want you here. Thank God people talk that way. I know if Lil would have ever once said anything about me drinking, I would have told her what she could have done with AA. And I would have walked out and drank myself to death. The only thing I'd done right in those next 2.5 years is I did go to meetings. And, you know, after I was around for a while and I was running with these guys that was in and out, you can get a lot of good information from these people. It's the wrong information, but you can get a lot of information. You know, I'm a beer alcoholic. My first drink was beer. I drank beer most of the time. And my last drunk was a beer drunk. And these guys told me that, hell, I'm going to AA. And he said, you shouldn't be drinking beer. They can smell that stuff. They said, drink vodka. So I started drinking vodka, and I drank vodka for, the next about 2 years, I guess. And I'd pull up to meetings such as this, you know, and I'd been drinking all day. I'd reach under that seat and grab that half pint, and I'd pull her out and take a big draw off of it, you know. And then I'd reach over and I'd grab me a whole pack of Clorets. I didn't just chew one piece. I'd dump the whole pack in. And my first sponsor used to say all the time when I walked through that door and you saw that green foam run out of my mouth, that's the way I was. And I didn't know all this was happening. And in the 2.5 years that I was around AA, I lost that insurance business that I'd gone into. I eventually got it back, but I lost a job in sales that I had spent 11 years with. I lost a house that Juan and I and his, at that time, 7 kids was living in, had to move in with her mother. And a lot of things happened in these 2.5 years. First thing was that job. I spent 11 years with that company and I had an excellent, excellent job, sales job. And I lived for the last 5 years on, he mailed my payroll check, my commission check, to my wife, my boss did. And I lived on my expense account. And I padded enough that I lived very well. And they began to call me in about my drinking. And I assured them I was doing okay. Most of the time, I was traveling through eastern Kentucky, and I'd leave on Monday morning, didn't get back to Friday night. And things were, I thought, was going pretty well. And my boss's brother was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd met George before. I knew he was a member of AA because I was around AA 2.5 years, you know. And George called me one Friday night when I got home, and he gave me some bad news. He said, Bob, we've been trying to get hold of you for a couple of weeks. No one could find you. And he said, my brother has fired you. And I got to thinking, my responsibility for these 7 kids, my responsibility as a father, you know. I got to crying crocodile tears to George that night. I said, "George, my God, I need that job bad." I said, "Things are going tough." I said, "Is there anything you can do for me?" He said, "I don't know, Bob. I'll call my brother and see if there's anything I can do for you, and I'll call you right back." It wasn't 15 minutes and George called me back. It seemed like 15 days before he called back, but he called back and he said, "Bob, I've got this mess all straightened out for you." He said, "You come on in the Monday morning," and he said, "For God's sakes, be sober." I said, "George, do you think I'd drink at a time like this?" And I didn't drink that weekend. But Monday morning, I got up early, started in the office, and I got about halfway in there, and I got thinking. Got to thinking about what my boss was going to say. Hell, I could have written the script out for him. I knew what he was going to say. And anyway, after I don't know how much I drank, but later that afternoon, I remember walking into that office. I remember reaching down in my pocket, taking the keys to put them in my hand, walked up to my boss's desk, and I threw those keys on his desk, and I said, "You keep your damn job. I don't need it." And I turned around and walked out. And to me, that's chronic alcoholism. I was dry Friday night, and I was concerned about some things. Monday afternoon, after a number of drinks, I was no longer concerned about that family. I was no longer concerned about sobriety, because I had taken a drink and I had to continue with my drinking, and I quit that job. Things went on down the hill. I lost that house, and I told you I was originally in the real estate business. I couldn't sell my own house. My mother-in-law sold it. It just about went down the tubes, and I moved in with her, and a lot of things was beginning to happen. Once again, I went down to Cumberland Lake to get away from the situation. I guess to get away from Juanita and the kids. I don't know why I went. I went down there to drink because I was with my drinking buddies. And I come back and I don't know. It seemed to me it was 2 or 3 days. Juanita said I was gone a couple of weeks. I really don't know. It doesn't make any difference. But I got back one Friday morning over at my mother-in-law's house, and I come back that Friday morning, and I took my key out, and I tried to get in the house, and I couldn't get in. My key didn't work. And I hollered for Juanita that morning. I said, "There's something wrong with this lock. My key won't work." She said, "There's nothing wrong with the locks." She said her mother had the locks changed. And I hollered for Juanita. I said, "Well, I'm going to need a key." And she said, "You don't get a key, Bob." I said, "Juanita, what do you mean I don't get a key?" I said, "Juanita, just what in the hell do you want from me, woman?" She said, "Bob, I want you to stop drinking." And I can remember that Friday morning, hollering back at Juanita through that door, "Juanita, I'd rather be dead, not be able to drink." And I turned around and walked out and went over to Wolford's Tavern to tell my buddies what all was taking place. And I drank beer that entire day. About 7:30 that night, I was so drunk, I decided, hell, they can't lock me in my house. Who they think they are? So I went over to tell them they couldn't lock me up. My key still didn't work that night, and I knocked the door down to get in. And I can vaguely remember my mother-in-law giving me one more chance. She said, "Bob, if you don't get off my property, I'm going to call the police and have you arrested." I said, "That's a fine thing to do, have your son-in-law arrested. Who's going to feed these 7 kids?" And she let me know who had been feeding them, I'll tell you. And she called the police on me. I went down to the basement, got my shotgun, 12-gauge Browning automatic. I remember picking up 2 full boxes of shells, and I don't know what I was going to do with 2 boxes of shells. But I remember putting 3 shells in that gun, and pushing that button, and that chamber slammed. I can hear that thing slamming right now. The next thing I vaguely remember when I stumbled up that stairway looking for that mother-in-law who incidentally had gone into her bedroom to get her gun. She was going to get rid of the problem that night. I can remember kids running and screaming to get away from their drunken maniac father. And it's a miracle that gun didn't go off that night. I had no intent. I don't think I had any intentions of shooting anyone. I wasn't that kind of a guy. I just... was trying to prove to them they couldn't treat me that way. But you know, when you're drunk and waving a gun around, it could have accidentally gone off. And I could have killed one of my children or several of them. And I stumbled up a stairway at night, went up into the attic. It was a warm November night. And Juanita was still home. She was getting dressed to go to her Al-Anon meeting that night over at the Pleasant Ridge group. And she called AA for me. My brother was at that meeting that night. There was a priest there. My first sponsor was there, and a guy by the name of Lawrence was there. Lawrence Jackie who brought me to my very first Mont Eagle Roundup down there, the third Roundup. Lawrence brought me down here. And they come over that night, and I didn't know anything that's taking place. I was okay up in that attic. But they said the police, we lived on a corner lot with a driveway, went all the way around, come out the side street. They said they had police cars all surrounded our house, had searchlights on the building. And Juanita said those radios were blasting right on Iroquois Parkway. And I didn't know any of this was going on. I was at peace with the world up there. Nobody bothering me. And I knew what the problem was. It wasn't alcohol. I didn't have any problem with alcohol. I had a problem with people. People caused me problems. That's what I was thinking up there. And the next thing I remember is somebody in a blue uniform. And this policeman stuck his head up there, and I told him I was going to blow his head off with that shotgun if he come up that stairway. And I normally didn't talk to policemen that way. And these AA people come over. This priest happened to be at the meeting that night. And I don't know to this day how they talked those police into leaving, why I wasn't arrested. They were going to shoot tear gas up in that attic, get me out of there. The only reason they didn't, because our seven children was upstairs too, and they didn't know where they were. The police left. My brother and Bill, my first sponsor, come up that stairway and asked me to give up the gun, and I did. I wasn't mad at anybody but that mother-in-law. They took me out and began to pour a little coffee down me, and I began to come to just a little bit. And once again, I went back that same old way of thinking I've done 1,000 times before. This was not my fault this happened. Alcohol had nothing to do with this. I blamed that mother-in-law. She's the one who called the police, and if it hadn't been for her, none of this would have occurred. And you know, I believe things like that all during my drinking career, that it was not my fault. It was always somebody else's fault. And they took me out to the Lady Peace Hospital, and the psychiatrist come in the next day. I wasn't even going to go to sleep. They put me to bed, and I came to that first morning. It was on a Saturday morning, and I got up and put my clothes on, and I went down to check out. I thought I was in some hotel, because I'd traveled all my life, you know, and I got down to the end of the hallway, and them doors are locked, and I realized where I was. And I swore that morning I'd get even with these damn guys putting me in here if it's the last thing I do. Psychiatrists come in to see me, and I'm not downing the medical profession. This man was a good psychiatrist, could have helped me, I would have given him a chance. But I told him what I thought of him. And anyway, he called my wife Saturday afternoon and said, "I'm afraid your husband will die hopeless drunk. He doesn't want any help." Thank God the people in AA didn't believe that. A lot of AA people come to the hospital to see me. And I'll never forget, I sat in a hospital in the dark at nighttime. I would not burn their lights. And you know, with an attitude like that, you ought to die drunk. But Bill come in, flipped them lights on. He had a few choice words to say to me. I can't repeat in this podium. But I lied to Bill, and I lied to all you AA people come to see me. Now, I'd been around AA 2.5 years at this time, abusing my privileges around AA. And yet these AA people come to see me. They turned me loose Tuesday morning at that hospital because I wouldn't let them help me. And as soon as I got out of the hospital, I got to thinking, what happened to my three drinking buddies? One of the guys, these three guys that were my buddies were more important to me and my family when I was drinking. One of them owned that tavern. The other boy was in the real estate business. The other boy owned a large construction company. And we've run around together and we've done things together that I can't describe here. They were more important to me than anyone in the world. But when I got out of the hospital, I wondered, what happened to them? Why didn't they come to the hospital to see me? And I know tonight why they didn't come. I feel sure if any one of them would have showed up, would have given me a reason to go back to that tavern. But I got to thinking about you AA people that you care. People that I had abused for 2.5 years. They came to the hospital to see me. And I went in that morning to talk to my sponsor about this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we had a long talk that day. And Bill said, Bob, why don't you try it our way for just 6 weeks? He said, if you don't like it, they'll still be selling that stuff. And that's the way I come into AA. And that was back on the 9th of November, 1962, and I've not had a drink of alcohol since then. And I don't know exactly when things changed. I don't know if it was 6 days. I don't know if it was 6 weeks or 6 months. But before long, I liked being sober. I don't know exactly when it happened. It was a gradual thing, I guess. And I still have that same feeling tonight. I like being sober. I really do. Being sober is just a great, great thing. We continued going to AA. Juanita got real involved in that one on. And on the November the 9th, I sobered up, 1962, and the Derby rolled around on May Day, 63, about 6 months later. And I'd worked at the Derby tending bar for many years to make extra money, and I was a bartender out there, and I usually got drunker than the fans, but I was worried about going to that Derby. And Lawrence Jackie said, Bob, you don't have to go to the Derby this year. Why don't you come with me? I said, where are you going, Lawrence? He said, I'm going to Mount Eagle, the Mount Eagle Roundup. And that was the third roundup. And Lawrence brought me down here, and I guess I've been to, I don't know, 80 or 90 of these roundups since that time. And I've had so many people that crossed through my lives here. You'd think that things would be okay in my life, and they are okay. Things are good now. But maybe 6 years ago, I was sober 50 years. I remember on my 50-year anniversary, Juanita was there and all my children were there at my birthday. And things were going really good then. And you'd think someone with 50 years sobriety ought to have life whipped, you know, everything's okay. But the last 5 years have been tough for me, real tough. First, I come down with prostate cancer, and I had 45 radiation treatments, and I got through that okay. I had a hip replaced, and I got through that okay. And about 4 years ago, many of you probably remember me here at Mount Eagle. I used to cough all the time. I had a terrible cough and could never. I always blamed it on sitting in all them smoking rooms years ago. But I finally went to a doctor and he couldn't figure out what it was. And he said, I'm going to send you to a blood specialist. There's something wrong. And he sent me to this specialist and they sent me over to the Cancer Institute and they found out I had multiple myeloma cancer. It's cancer of the blood. And it scared me to death, and because my daughter happens to work there. It was her doctor that diagnosed me, and he said he was going to put me on chemo, and that scared me to death. And they put me on a real light dose of chemo. It's a pill I take, and I'm still taking it today. I take it for 7 days, and I'm off 7 days, and then back on 7 days, and it's doing its job. My cancer's down to zero, and I'm okay there. And that kind of scared me to death. And just recently, I go in once a month for blood work, and it always comes back to zero. Everything's fine. And the chemo doesn't bother me. And it helps. To me, it's like taking an aspirin. I don't. The only problem with it, it's a very expensive pill. But I've been fortunate enough to get some grants where it doesn't cost me anything. So things are good there. But I asked this doctor, I said, okay, when am I going to be able to stop taking this stuff? He said, you're not never going to stop taking it. He said, it's doing its job and you're going to keep taking it. And I got through all that and never thought about taking a drink over it. But along while these things was happening to me, a few things was happening to Juanita, and I need to tell you about it. For 50 years in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, one end I went to meetings, we went to meetings together, and I hugged a lot of men, and I hugged a lot of women. And one end I hugged a lot of women, and I hugged a lot of men. And it was fine for 50 years. And then things began to happen. Juanita began to complain about how I was hugging women. And the kids called me in and said, Dad, you got to stop hugging these women at AA. It's just upsetting Mom. And I tried to back off, but sometime I'd forget. And Juanita complained about it, and things was really starting downhill. And I didn't know what was happening. Had no idea. And my oldest daughter's an RN, and she set up an appointment that I'd take one in to a psychiatrist, and I took her to this psychiatrist, and we went for about 6 or 8 months, I guess, and he diagnosed her coming down with Alzheimer's. And it really, really concerned me, and the kid said, I know in AA y'all hug a lot, but you got to stop doing this. And I stopped for a while, and it didn't make any difference, really. Wanda began to get worse. She got to the point where she could hardly remember anything. And we continued to go to AA and Al-Anon during all this. And I will be forever grateful for the program of Al-Anon and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Juanita, those of you knew Juanita, or some of you probably didn't know Juanita. Juanita was a beautiful young lady, and Juanita had a terrific personality. She was a good storyteller. She could tell you the same story, and she could tell you about a lake drying up and make it exciting, I tell you. And she began to tell stories around AA. Some of them were true, some of them weren't true. And we'd go to AA meeting, and she'd tell the person the same story 3 or 4 times that night. And I'll never forget how kind AA people were to her. But they never once said, Juanita, you told me this story 2 times already. Why are you telling me again? They just listened because they knew long before I did what was happening. And things continued to go downhill. Juanita got to the point where she wouldn't bathe. She wouldn't take her medicine. And anything I would do seemed to upset her. And she began to have automobile wrecks. Eventually had to take her car away from her, sold her car, and told her the insurance company bought it. I had to lie to her about it. But we continued to go to AA, and I was so grateful the way we were accepted. It got me through 3 years of Juanita coming down with Alzheimer's that I wouldn't have been able to get through had it not been for the program of Al-Anon now and AA. And she eventually got so bad that the kids and I had a meeting, and they said, Dad, this is beginning to wear on you. You got to do something. You got to put Mom in a memory home. I said, no, I'm not going to do that. I could never put one in a home. I'm going to keep her here. I can handle this. We'll be okay. But we weren't okay. We kept going downhill. One day it got very violent. Very violent. She tried a number of times to kill me. She got the butcher knife about one night. And eventually got to the point where I had to do something. And kids and I had another meeting, and we decided just almost 2 years ago today to do something. And I made arrangements to put one in a memory home. It's a very fine home, and I'll never forget the day we went out there. One didn't want to know where we was going, and I lied to her. I said, we're going out to see the doctor. And I said, you may not be able to come back here to the house because I'm going to have the house remodeled. And we're not going to be able to stay here. I said, you're going to stay out here at this place, and I'm going to get me an apartment somewhere. And I guess she accepted that, and we took her out to this memory home. Four of my children was with me, two boys and two daughters. And we took her in, introduced to the doctor. The doctor, he said, it's time for y'all to leave. He said, I'll take care of Juanita. We walked out that door, out the front door, and they locked that damn door behind me when I left. And I realized that morning what I had done. I'd put Juanita in a lockdown facility. And I hated myself for that. I called my sponsor and talked with him. He said, Bob, you done the right thing. Just because it was the right thing doesn't make it any easier at all. And the thing that I was blessed with this is Juanita was okay living there. She got the point very shortly. The time she was there, 2 weeks, she thought she was home. She was okay with being there. And I was blessed with this because a lot of people in that place didn't want to be there. They wanted out every day. But Juanita was okay with that. She didn't know who I was. She didn't know who the kids were. But I went to see her every day. After I sold that house and bought a little condo close to where she was, and I was able to get there every day. And I saw her really begin to go downhill. But you know, even in that memory home, I was sitting there, she was there about, must have been maybe a, I don't know, 4, 5, 6, 8 months. I don't know how long it was. Don't make a difference. But I was sitting there with her one time, and this other lady who was a patient there started crying about something. And Juanita got up and put her arms around that lady and said, honey, everything's going to be okay. You're going to be all right. And that was Al-Anon coming out in her. Al-Anon coming out. Juanita had 57 years in Al-Anon, and she lived there for 16 months, and things were downhill all the way, you know. And I'd gotten out of talking anywhere. I did not, in those 16 months that Juanita was in there, I did not get out of the habit of going to AA. I continued to take my meetings because I needed you people. And I tell you about this for several reasons. All that Juanita went through and I went through with her, I never once thought about taking a drink of alcohol. Never crossed my mind. Because I just kept close to AA and talked to these people, and y'all kept encouraging me. You kept telling me it's okay. Everything's going to be okay. You done. And that, without the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, not drinking would not have been the right thing. The right thing would have been, I'm an alcoholic. And the normal thing for me to have done when situations like that occur would be to take a drink of alcohol. But that never crossed my mind. And so the last 16 months while he was in there, I didn't make any conventions. I didn't get down here to Montego. I think I come maybe one time while she was in there. And I got the opportunity to go to the Music City Roundup. It's over the 4th of July, and the kids said they'd go out and see Mom that weekend, and I it's okay to go. So I went to the Music City Roundup, and I also happened to be the oldest member there, and I presented my book to the youngest man there about 9 o'clock at night, and about 11 o'clock at night, I got that phone call, and this kid said, "Dad, you better come home. Mom has fallen, and she's in the hospital." So I hurried home, got home, and went in to see her, and we talked with a doctor, and one had a slight heart attack, and she had a gallbladder infection and a urinary tract infection and just a whole lot of things wrong. And we talked with that doctor, and I said, "Can't you do surgery?" He said, "No." He said, "Surgery will kill her." And I met with my children that night. We made the decision to turn her over to hospice. They put Wani up on the sixth floor. They put morphine or whatever it is in them, and no water, no food. And 31 hours, Wani was gone. 31 hours is all. And she didn't suffer. And prior to that, the last 6 months, Wani was in at home. I prayed. Lots of nights, I prayed for Wani to die. And this worried me. I talked to my sponsor, I talked to a lot of AA people about it. "Is it okay to pray for your wife to die?" They convinced me, yeah, it was okay because of the shape she was in. And that morning, on the 4th of July, just last year, it'll be 1 year this 4th of July, Wanda did die. And I'd prayed for 6 months for her to die, but when she died, I wasn't ready for it. And I found in this program, you better be careful what you pray for, because sometimes it'll come true. But after it was all over, I was okay with Wani's death. I'm okay with it tonight. I'm okay with it because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, and I think about the life that we had. Wani and I had 67 years together of marriage, and it's been a tremendous journey. It's not, I don't know how to describe it. I'm lonely sometimes, especially I live alone, especially at nighttime. I do pretty good during the day. I'm usually at AA meetings. I'm a meeting maker. I make 2 or 3, sometimes 4 meetings a day. And it keeps me occupied, and that's what I need right now. And I go home from that 8 o'clock meeting, get home about 9:30, and watch TV for 30 minutes, and then I get to thinking a lot of times about Wani, and I miss her, and then I get to thinking about the 67 years that we had together, and thank God for what we had. So it's been a good journey, and I need to tell you also, before I close, about some of these grandchildren. I don't know if any of you guys ever seen a baby born in this world? We only had 9, I didn't. Back when we had children, they didn't allow the father back in the delivery room. Not at all. And I'll tell you, when I was drinking, what having a child meant to me. It meant Wani was going to be in that hospital. And back then, they kept them 3 or 4 days. And I could drink and do what I wanted to do for 3 or 4 days. I'm ashamed to say that, but that's what I thought about having a child, what it meant to me. I don't know what these guys do today. They're drinking. Hell, their wives, they go in to now have that baby, and the next morning they're home. Sometimes it's same night. You know, it just don't give you a chance to get drunk. But I got to see a grandson born in this world. My daughter, Mary Rose, invited Wani and I both into the delivery room. And I didn't realize what a woman went through to have a baby. But we were there, and that baby was crowned, and the doctor grabbed him. And it wasn't but just a minute that he cleaned up, and I got to hold that boy in my arms. And it was, you don't get any closer to God than that. It doesn't get any more spiritual than that. And I'd have missed out on that had it not been for the program of AA and Al-Anon. And I've got an adopted granddaughter that my second oldest daughter never married. She come out one day, and this has been 22 years ago. She come out and said she wanted to adopt a baby. And I thought, well, hell, why don't you get married and do it like one end? And I'd done it, you know. And she didn't want any part of that. And she said she was going to adopt this baby from Paraguay, the Grani Indian baby. And wanted and got to go with Pam over to pick up Emily, 5 months old. And they went to Paraguay to pick up this baby, and they said they'd be back in about a week or 10 days. And it took almost 6 or 7 weeks to get back, because the time they got over there, the rumor got out in Paraguay that the American women were coming over there adopting babies and then bringing back to the States for their organs. And they had a tough time getting out of Paraguay, but eventually they got back, and I got to meet Emily, 5-month-old, Grani Indian baby, dark skin, black hair, black eyes, and just a beautiful young thing. And I got very close to Emily. We had a motor home at that time, and we began going to conventions and traveling and taking Emily along. And when Emily was about, 2.5 years old, maybe, we was up in Washington, D.C. And after the convention, we was out shopping. And Emily messed in her diapers, what happened, and Pam said she's going to take her back and clean her. I said, no, you and Mom, y'all go on with your shopping. You let me do this. I took Emily back to the motor home and cleaned her up, and we didn't go back shopping. We laid there on the couch, and that little girl reached over and put her arms around me, and I put my arms around her, and we laid there, and we bonded that day. And, you know, I never got the opportunity to bond with any of my 9 children. I was too drunk when 7 of them were born. And when the last 2 was born, I was too busy going to AA to bond with my own children. But I realize tonight that God never takes anything away from us, that He don't always have something to offer in return. And Emily and I are very, very close. She comes over every Sunday with my children and brings lunch over for me. And that little girl's, like I said, 22 years old. She's in law school and at the top of her class at the University of Louisville now. And so many benefits have come my way in this program. It's just, I am so fortunate. And I continue to go to AA because I like going to AA. And over the years I've been in, I've experienced a lot of people who stopped going to AA. And before long they're drinking. Before long they're trying to come back to AA, and most of them never make it back. And I have convinced myself over these 55 and a half years that if I ever make up my mind and stop going to meetings, I will drink again. And the reason I know that is because if I stop going to meetings, I've already made my mind up. I don't need meetings, and I don't need you people. And I will drink again. I'm convinced of that, and I've seen people do it. I continue to see miracles happen in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I saw a miracle happen just this past Wednesday. I want to tell you about this little guy. Been around the program 20-some years. Could not stay sober. And I'm not real close to Mike. I've known him. I know his dad. His dad's been sober some 40 years in the program. I've known Mike over his 20 years. I saw him in and out and get drunk and all these things and come back to AA. And for some reason, we got to talking and he said he didn't have a car and he had trouble getting to meetings. I said, well, hell, Mike, I can pick you up, no problem. So he called me Wednesday morning. He said, Bob, will you pick me up? Take me to a meeting with you. I said, sure will. So I picked Mike up. And on the way out to the meeting, I got to talking to Mike and I said, Mike, you've been around 20 years now, and have you thought about really what's taking place? Why you keep going out and drinking? He said, it's Derby weekend. I said, well, what the hell has that got to do? He said, I go to parties. He said, that's whenever I get, the last 20 years, every time I've gotten drunk, it's been right before the Derby weekend. I said, well, gosh, I didn't know that. We went to that meeting that morning, and you know, the chairman that morning opened the meetings with all the readings, and he said, you know, this is Derby weekend, and I'm sure a lot of you people get drunk on Derby weekends. Is there anyone in the room this morning who may be having trouble staying sober on Derby weekends? And Mike said, yeah, it's me. And he bared his soul and he bared his heart that morning. And I don't think that's a coincidence. I think that's a miracle. I think miracles continue to happen in this program. That's another reason I keep coming. I'm a miracle. I think we're all miracles in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just been I told you I was nervous when I started, and I really was, because I remember so many things that have taken place here. So many things have taken place over the years, and I remember so many of the old-timers that aren't around anymore. And that's going to be happening to me for long. I don't know. I'm 86 years old now. Pretty good health, I guess. I don't know. The doctor says I'm in good health. But I pretty much do what I want to do, what I'm able to do. Bruce and I went a little hiking over the weekend. I didn't go hike very far, but I get around okay, and I'm blessed there. I hope that I have said something to all you people that are here that you can take with you. It's been a pleasure being here. And I like to say something, you know, talking to all you people, that this message, if I have said something that means something to you, you know, you're going to take it back to your home group. And you're going to say something to someone else about it. And they're going to say something to someone else. And that's how the word spreads, the miracle in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm happy to be here, happy to share it with you, and hope that I've said something that will be of some help to you. Thank you so much for having me.